and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the 50th anniversary celebrations of the March on Washington for Jobs and Justice, at which three U.S. presidents spoke. Gerald Horn, Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston, joins us to discuss today's spending priorities on the eve of another war and the enduring guns and butter arguments that Martin Luther King addressed as the war in Vietnam robbed Americans of a victory in the war on poverty. Then we'll speak with Michael Long, a professor of religious studies and peace and conflict studies, and the author of a new book, I Must Resist, Bayard Rustin's Life in Letters. We will discuss this gay pacifist and consummate organizer, Bayard Rustin, who, because of homophobia, was denied credit as the principal organizer of the March on Washington 50 years ago, and his belated recognition by President Obama, who will soon posthumously award Bayard Rustin the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Then finally, following cyber attacks by the Syrian Electronic Army that disrupted Twitter and the New York Times website, we'll look into this shadowy group of hackers who claim they have no ties to the Syrian government, even though Assad referred to them as a real army in a virtual reality. Alan Paller, a leading expert on cybersecurity, joins us to discuss how these hacking attacks are organized and the role of organized crime in cyberspace. And joining us now is Gerald Horn, the John Jay and Rebecca Morris Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. His research has addressed issues of racism in a variety of relations involving labor, politics, civil rights, international relations, and war. He has written more than two dozen books, including The Color of Fascism, Lawrence Dennis, Racial Passing, and the Rise of Right-Wing Extremism in the United States, Fire This Time, The Watts Uprising in the 1960s, and most recently, Negro Comrades of the Crown, African Americans and the British Empire Fight the U.S. Before Emancipation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gerald Horn.
Thank you for inviting me.
And the celebrations on the 50th anniversary of the famous speech in Washington, the March on Washington, largely attributed to Martin Luther King, I Had a Dream. Of course, the actual march was about jobs and justice. Did you feel that the issues of jobs and justice came up adequately today, Gerald, given that three former presidents spoke?
Well, generally speaking, yes. I think that the remarks by Mr. Obama in particular spoke to that question. He spoke about the racial wealth gap. He spoke about the fact that unemployment is higher in the black community than in the white community. But obviously, there was a difficulty embedded in his remarks insofar as he spoke rather eloquently about the legacy of August 28, 1963, but no doubt rushed off afterwards to a meeting of his National Security Council where the bombing of Syria is no doubt being plotted for the next 24 to 48 hours. Dr. King spoke of how the United States would have difficulty in enjoying both guns and butter. And 50 years later, we have that same dilemma. It's unclear to me how the United States can address homelessness and hunger while spending billions of dollars on a military-industrial complex, not to mention plotting the launching of Tomahawk missiles into the suburbs of Damascus.
And when Martin Luther King, back during the Vietnam days, brought up the guns and butter argument and made the point that it's a sort of zero-sum game, that we either can win the war on poverty or win the war in Vietnam, and I think most historians agree that the Vietnam War derailed the war on poverty, which remains inconclusive and unfinished. Do you think that that same dynamic operates today?
I'm afraid so, and unfortunately it's baked into the cake. Unfortunately, the structure of global politics to a degree involves the United States, quote, providing a defense umbrella, unquote, for large swaths of this small planet, and that includes Saudi Arabia, that includes Israel as well. And so when it comes to attacking the Assad regime in Damascus, it's not just the White House that gets a vote. It's not just Congress that gets a vote. It's not just the U.S. people and the peace lobby in the United States that gets a vote. the regime in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, has influence, and the Israeli lobby and the Israeli government have influence as well. In return for providing this so-called defense umbrella for Saudi Arabia, for example, petrodollars are circulated into the U.S. economy. We know that members of the Saudi ruling elite are major investors in Twitter and Apple Computer, not to mention Fox News. And so because of the structure of U.S. politics, the United States is pushed towards these kinds of adventures. As former U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright once said, it's very difficult to have this well-funded war machine without the impulse arising to somehow deploy it on many different occasions. And that's the difficult dilemma that the United States faces at this particular moment.
But if indeed we are the empire, the last empire, and if the president is the Caesar of the American empire, I don't understand why the empire can't get its subject nations that it protects, like Saudi Arabia, to play ball. Because let's face it, it's the Saudis who are funding the al-Nusra Front, who may take over Syria, and that, of course, is a nightmare. This is an al-Qaeda-affiliated organization. We are supposed to be here fighting a war on terror with al-Qaeda as our principal enemy. So arguably, both the Russians and the Americans have something in common here, which is Russia doesn't want al-Qaeda to take over Syria, neither does the United States. Yet the Saudis are the ones that have been funding these guys, you know. So how do you explain that?
Well, it's not just the Saudis. As you well know, Prime Minister David Cameron in London is also pushing for an attack on Damascus. I'm sure you heard the remarks of French President Francois Hollande, which basically leaned in the same direction. We know that former French President Nicolas Sarkozy has been negotiating with Qatar, the oil and gas-rich Arab country, about being their face of investment in France and in Paris. We know that the Turkish regime as well is very upset with Bashar al-Assad, and they're pushing for some kind of attack on Damascus as well. Given that strong push and given that strong impetus, it seems that the United States will be pushed towards making what it seems to me will be a major blunder, if not a crime, that is to say, attacking the al-Assad regime. And I choose the word crime very carefully because I don't think there will be a Security Council mandate with regard to such an attack, which means that the Obama administration is skating on very thin and questionable legal ice.
Gerald Horn, again, is the John J. and Rebecca Morris Chair of History and African-American Studies at the University of Houston. His research has addressed issues of racism in a variety of relations involving labor, politics, civil rights, international relations, and war. He's written more than two dozen books, and we are discussing the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington for Jobs and Justice. And let me just return to that, to today's speech, particularly by the president, where he talked about, he characterized Wall Street rather accurately, where he talked about greed is good and passion is ineffective. And he said this in the context of this prevailing idea that economic growth automatically generates winners and losers. And it's unfortunate we have casualties, but that's just too bad.
Well, what Mr. Obama was sketching is a fact that it's very difficult for many of us to confront, which is that you have a very powerful right-wing movement in this country. You had it in 1963 at the time of Mr. King's speech. That is to say, the John Birch Society was riding high in 1963, just like the Tea Party movement is riding high in 2013. As a result, it's very difficult to get any kind of progressive legislation, or any kind of legislation for that matter, through this do-nothing Congress. A transportation bill, for example, would generate countless jobs and would not only benefit contractors who generally vote for the Republicans, but would also benefit construction workers and would therefore cut into this very high rate of unemployment amongst black and brown workers in particular. But given the strength of the right wing, given the strength of the Tea Party caucus, it's very difficult to get any sort of traction on such a bill or any other kind of legislation coming out of Washington as we speak.
Well, one of the a lot of the placards that were on display today were referring to the recent overturning of the most important part of the Voting Rights Act, the preclearance of the southern states. And it was mentioned by all three presidents who spoke. And it strikes me as a somewhat bitter irony that the American right, and in particular John Roberts, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, in fact, are using, in quotes, the success of the civil rights movement against American minorities by saying, oh, it's all over now, so we don't need these protections. Does that strike you as an irony?
Well, it not only strikes me as an irony, it has struck Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg of the U.S. Supreme Court as ironic indeed. For example, in her opinion dissenting from the Holder case, in which the Supreme Court basically gutted the Voting Rights Act of 1965, she noted quite sagely that what the Supreme Court basically said was that you should throw away your umbrella when it's raining if somehow the drops are missing you because you're under an all or shutter. And I think that it's apparent, as the press has pointed out, that Justice Robert is playing a long game. That is to say that he is putting forward a very adroit strategy to reverse the gains of the 1960s. We know that affirmative action is hanging by a thread as a result of the University of Texas case that the Supreme Court also ruled on. I should also point out that it is the long-range ambition of the right wing in the United States to not only reverse the gains of the 1960s, but to reverse the gains of the 1930s. That is to say, to put a bullseye on the back of Social Security and unemployment compensation, the other kinds of social democratic gains that arose during that tumultuous decade. And I'm afraid to say that they're well on their way to accomplishing those long-cherished goals.
Well, Gerald Hall, I recall somebody saying to me recently that, you know, it's not that the Republicans want to overturn and destroy the legacy of FDR. They also would like to go after the other Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, the trust buster. And frankly, the irony is that antitrust has almost disappeared, and a lot of the evisceration of antitrust happened actually under a Democratic president, Bill Clinton.
That is true, although I have to say that I was struck by the fact that with regard to the latest airline merger, that the Justice Department has stepped in and is taking a very close look at that particular case, which no doubt will lead to litigation. But like anything else in this country, everything comes back to the correlation of political forces. And right now, one has to say that even though the conservatives did not prevail in their race to gain the White House in 2012, it does appear that they will hold on to the House in the 2014 elections, and there is a distinct possibility, according to the electoral guru Nate Silver, that they will reclaim the U.S. Senate. On the other side of the ledger, we see that the labor movement, which has been the bulwark of progressive politics historically in the United States, continues to be in decline, continues to be eclipsed. That is to say that the sector of the private sector workers that the labor movement has helped to organize continues to diminish, and their grip on the public sector continues to diminish as well, because the right wing has been so adept at emasculating the government and emasculating the public sector as a whole. So I'm not trying to present a pessimistic picture, but on the other hand, it seems to me we have to be realistic as we go forward.
Well, but this gets down to numbers, doesn't it, Gerald Horn? I mean, in other words, in 2008, when Obama was swept in, over 140 million Americans voted. 2 years later, in 2010, in a coup organized largely by Karl Rove and ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, with funding, almost unlimited funding, from the American Petroleum Institute, they pulled off a coup, but they only did it because half the people voted in 2010 in the midterm, which was about 75 million. If that happens again in 2014, if the people who showed up that saved us from having Mitt Romney as our president, if they don't show up this coming year in 2014 in the midterms, then what you just said, or what you quoted Nate Silver saying, will happen. So go figure. Explain to me why it is that the American people don't see this urgency that they vote for the president, but they don't recognize that he can't get anything done with these Tea Party people. And if the Tea Party people take over the Senate, then forget about it.
Well, you're making a good point. But as you well know, in the wake of the decision by the U.S. Supreme Court on the Voting Rights Act, you had a number of southern states in particular that rushed to change their laws with regard to voting. For example, in the state of North Carolina, there was a monster bill that was passed weeks after the Supreme Court decision that, among other things, helps to make sure that those without proper ID will not have an opportunity to cast their ballot. I'm sure you recall that in the state of Texas, they tried to engineer legislation which said that a hunting license would be proper ID, but student identification would not. There have been attempts in a number of southern states to remove polling booths from college campuses, for example, and indeed to forbid college students from casting their votes where they go to school. Presumably, that is consistent with the Supreme Court decision. We know that the Justice Department is rushing into court trying to reverse a number of these decisions, but once again, they're rushing into courts. They're rushing into courts where the right wing historically, or at least for the last few decades, has held sway.
And that's because we have not elected enough the Democratic presidents, or at least presidents that aren't determined to empower the right, as Republican presidents have, with Justices Scalia, Alito, Thomas, and Kennedy. So, again, it gets down to showing up at the polls and voting in their interest, doesn't it?
It certainly does, but it's just like 100,000 people showing up in Washington, D.C. this past Saturday. That doesn't happen by accident. It takes organization. It takes funding. And if you compare the United States to its peer nations, comparing it to Germany, for example, or even to France or Japan, it's easy to conclude that the progressive movement and the left-wing movement in the United States is much weaker than it is in peer nations. It's also easy to say that the trade unions are weaker in the United States than in peer nations. What that adds up to is a difficulty in shaping the political consciousness of working-class people, of poor people, etc. It leads to a situation where the depoliticizing of great swaths of the United States population takes place, and that, I'm afraid, helps to benefit the right wing and conservative hegemony.
Well, Gerald Horn, is there a note that we can end on here that reflects some of the optimism that's being generated by this 50th anniversary, that change can happen, and even though we have ebbs and flows of progressive movements and then regressive movements and reactionary movements in the United States, any light at the end of the tunnel here?
Absolutely. The March on Washington, despite some weaknesses that took place this past Saturday, was a magnificent display of progressive politics, with the focus on voting rights, with the focus on racial justice, with the focus on the George Zimmerman acquittal, with the focus on mass incarceration, particularly of people of color. The Dream Defenders, who in the state of Florida were trying to press the legislature to move against the so-called Stand Your Ground laws. The Dreamers, the young people, mostly of Mexican origin, who have been pushing for immigration reform. I think there are a number of positive developments that are taking place in the United States, significant developments. I just think that we need more attention to the rudiments and the ABCs of organizing if we are to halt this right-wing advance.
Well, Gerald Horn, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Again, I've been speaking with Gerald Horn, who's the John Jay and Rebecca Morse Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. His research has addressed issues of racism in a variety of relations involving labor, politics, civil rights, international relations, and war. He has written more than 24 books, including The Color of Fascism, Lawrence Dennis, Racial Passing, and The Rise of Right-Wing Extremism in the United States, Fire This Time, The Watts Uprising, and the 1960s, and most recently, Negro Comrades of the Crown, African Americans and the British Empire Fight the U.S. Before Emancipation. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the principal organizer of the March on Washington 50 years ago, Bayard Rustin.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. We shall overcome. We shall overcome.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Long, a professor of religious studies and peace and conflict studies at Elizabethtown College, and the author and editor of several books on civil rights, religion, and politics in mid-century America, including Marshalling Justice, the early civil rights letters of Thurgood Marshall, First Class Citizenship, the civil rights letters of Jackie Robinson, and his latest book, I Must Resist, Bayard Rustin's Life in Letters. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Long.
And it's great to be with you.
And it's an extraordinary story here about the person who really did was the principal organizer of the March on Washington 50 years ago, Bayard Rustin. And it's extraordinary to think that you have this African-American socialist pacifist who was openly gay in the 1950s having such an extraordinary link to all of these people like Martin Luther King and others who brought about the civil rights movement, and yet we know so little about him.
That's right. We know so little about him for a whole variety of reasons. He was not the leader of a civil rights organization. He wasn't a major leader in the black church, and he certainly wasn't a political leader. And those were the typical venues through which people rose and became leaders in the African-American community at this point. But Bayard was a behind-the-scenes strategist, and sometimes he was there willingly, and sometimes he was pushed to that area and kept there by his colleagues in the civil rights movement. So we know very little about him as well, although we're learning more, but we know little about him as well because his colleagues did a pretty darn good job of keeping him in the shadows, in the long shadows that they cast. And they did that primarily because of two reasons. One, his open gay sexuality, and two, his roots in communism.
So, nevertheless, though, he served as a mentor to Martin Luther King. He schooled King in Gandhi and nonviolence, and he introduced King to national leaders across the country. But I understand that there was a tension between him and King because of Bayard's sexuality. And then in 1960, Martin Luther King cut Bayard Rustin out of his inner circle after Adam Clayton Powell threatened to tell the media that King and Bayard Rustin were having a gay affair. Is that's the story?
Unfortunately, that is the story. In 1960, Bayard, the great organizer, was getting Martin Luther King and the great labor leader A. Philip Randolph together to announce marches on both political conventions that summer. and Adam Clayton Powell of Harlem, the Reverend and Representative Adam Clayton Powell of Harlem, got wind of it. And for a variety of reasons, he wasn't too interested in a march on the Democrats. And so he had an intermediary call King with the threat that he would tell, he, Adam Clayton Powell, would tell the media that King and Rustin were having a gay affair. Of course, they were not. I shouldn't say of course. They were not having a gay affair. The threat was hollow, but King was not a profile in courage on this point in 1960. And so at the urging of some conservative Baptist ministers in his own circle, as well as others, he cut Rustin out of the inner circle for 2 long years. And it really devastated Byard. And I dare to say it was a brutal act of discrimination against him.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Long, Professor of Religious Studies and Peace and Conflict Studies at Elizabethtown College and the author and editor of several books on civil rights, religion, and politics in mid-century America, including Marshalling Justice, the Early Civil Rights Letters of Thurgood Marshall, First Class Citizenship, the Civil Rights Letters of Jackie Robinson, and his latest book, I Must Resist, Byard Rustin's Life in Letters. And Byard Rustin, of course, will be very soon awarded posthumously the Presidential Medal of Freedom by President Obama. So finally, this person who was a pacifist, who resisted the draft in World War II, who was openly gay, who played this extraordinary role behind the scenes, is going to be recognized. Tell me, though, about his arrest in California in 1953. What was that about?
In January 1953, just after the new year, Rustin traveled to Pasadena, California. He was there partly as a representative of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, which was the major pacifist organization at this point. And he was speaking to a group of university women in Pasadena. He gave a rousing lecture on world peace, by all accounts. And then later on, he decides to stroll the streets of Pasadena, and around 2:45 in the morning, he's arrested by some police officers for engaging in sex in a car in public. And he was arrested for that, and A.J. Musty, who was leading the FOR at that point, had enough. A.J. Musty said that there were incidents prior to this, and he had actually told Byard that if another one happened, he would fire him. And indeed, that's what happened. Byard got cut from the FOR, the Fellowship of Reconciliation. And that's another tragic story. He and Musty had been good friends for a long time, and Musty was a mentor, a father figure to him as well. But the nice thing about it is that the war resisters picked up Byard, and it's from there that he launched into the civil rights movement. Another good thing about this story is that A. Philip Randolph, the great labor leader, grew closer to Byard through these incidents, these tragic incidents that he suffered throughout his life. And even King wanted Byard back after he cut him in 1960. Byard often said that, "I love Dr. King, but he really couldn't organize a couple of vampires to go to a bloodbath." And that gives you some indication of what Byard meant to King. Rustin was a brilliant organizer, and King needed Rustin to transfer those dreams that King had in his head into everyday reality. He needed a brilliant tactician, somebody who knew the nuts and bolts of organizing and grassroots campaigns. And Byard had learned that at the Fellowship of Reconciliation. Rustin had also been part of the March on Washington movement that A. Philip Randolph started way back in the 1940s. So he had this rich tradition of organizing folks for equal justice under law.
And he sounds a little like Walter Reuther, who also, of course, was helpful in helping organize this March on Washington. But I take it the long and the short of it is, I'm talking about Walter Reuther in terms of his extraordinary accomplishments. You know, Reuther, for example, founded the Sierra Club, among many, many things, and Earth Day. So he's a remarkable man, and so apparently is Byard Rustin. But it was largely because of homophobia that he didn't get credit for organizing, along with Randolph, the March on Washington 50 years ago.
I think that's largely true. In fact, just before the march, Senator Strom Thurmond of South Carolina took to the Senate floor and he brought up this arrest in Pasadena and accused Byard of being guilty of sexual perversion. And he announced this on the Senate floor, and the news media launched on that, and they asked the civil rights leaders what they thought about it. But this time, what's really interesting, Ian, this time the civil rights leaders, including King, rallied around Byard and depicted him as absolutely essential to the march. So that was a really interesting point in Byard's life. It was the first time he felt his colleagues in the civil rights movement rallying around him and supporting him in spite of what they considered to be a problem in his life and a problem for their lives as well. Finally, they were coming around, and he puts it at one point that they finally get a backbone.
So if Strom Thurmond, old tangerine hair, who'd never resisted a chance to pinch the backside of a female senator or ended up having an African-American illegitimate child, did J. Edgar Hoover also go after Byard?
Yes, J. Edgar Hoover did go after Byard. He got permission from Robert F. Kennedy, the Attorney General under the Kennedy administration, to tap Byard and to conduct surveillance. And, you know, Robert F. Kennedy wasn't a big fan of Byard and said some disparaging remarks about him. And Hoover certainly was not a big fan of Byard as well, which makes the Presidential Medal of Freedom all the sweeter, doesn't it? Because at once, before Byard was depicted as an enemy of the government, an enemy of the state, somebody who's subverting good order, and now the White House is bestowing the Presidential Medal of Freedom on him. I love the turnaround. The irony of history, as they say.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Long, whose latest book is I Must Resist, Byard Rustin's Life in Letters. And Byard Rustin was the principal organizer of the March on Washington for Jobs and Justice 50 years ago. And we all recall, at least those of us who lived through the 60s, recall the how much Martin Luther King was vilified by the radical left and by the emerging Black Power movement. People like Malcolm X and others, not that Malcolm X ever referred to him in a disparaging way, but others did, calling Martin Luther King Uncle Tom, etc. How did Byard Rustin do in that regard? Because in spite of the fact that the government vilified him and saw him as an enemy and a communist and all this stuff, Byard Rustin refused to condemn the Vietnam War, and he was also critical of the Black Power movement.
He was critical of the Black Power movement. He was critical of Malcolm X as well. He and Malcolm debated several times in the early 1960s, including at Howard University and on public radio and so forth. But by June 1964, Byard starts to pull back from that. In fact, he refuses to debate Malcolm any longer. And that's partly because just before that, Malcolm had called for the formation of rifle clubs among African Americans who weren't being properly protected by their local police authorities. And Byard was very upset by that. He considered that call to be outside the mainstream of the civil rights movement. He also was concerned about Malcolm X's inclinations toward racial separatism at points. And Byard was part of the old guard. You know, the old guard of the civil rights movement squared off against Malcolm X and the Black Power movement from 64 on. And so you have Byard Rustin and Martin Luther King and Roy Wilkins and Whitney Young and some others who are part of the old guard, and they're in favor of full integration and nonviolence the whole way. And they're pitting themselves against Malcolm X and the Black Power movement, especially on those points. And it's really a battle for the soul of the civil rights movement. It's one of the best stories, I think, from 64 on. But yeah, Malcolm and Byard certainly did not see eye to eye, that's for sure. On Vietnam, you're right. Byard did not become a leader of the peace movement. In fact, he was vilified by his radical pacifist friends, who really wanted him to assume a leading role. And they think that they still think that he could have done a marvelous job as the leader of the pacifist movement during the Vietnam War. But Rustin decided that he would put his marbles into organizing coalitions with powerful politicians who might be able to move massive resources towards economic justice for poor whites and African Americans. And so at this point, Rustin is shifting from protest to politics, as he put it in a 1965 article. He wants to move off the streets and into the quarters of power, build coalitions with powerful politicians, not Dixiecrats, but liberal Democrats, so that he can win economic justice. It's a controversial move to this day.
Well, but
I
was going to say that I think that's extraordinary prescient of him because, you know, I've been talking to people lately who, about this idea that really, in many ways, it serves the interests of reactionaries in this country to separate race from class, that we really need affirmative action for class in as much as race, and that racism and division is a way to distract people, particularly poor whites, how much they have in common with African American and Latinos, since the middle class is being eviscerated and the only people that are winners in the last several decades have been the billionaires.
Well, I think that's a great point. I agree with you on that. And we have to remember that Byard was a labor leader. A. Philip Randolph was a labor leader, head of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. These guys are concerned about economic justice since the 30s. Byard was part of the Young Communist League in the late 1930s. In the 1940s, he becomes focused on economic justice as well. And that continues up through and past the March on Washington. I'll say this as well. I think that Byard is somebody who really encouraged King to tie the issues of race and class together as well. And King begins to do that, especially after the March on Washington, and says things like, what good is segregation if I can't go to a restaurant? I'm sorry, what good is desegregation if I can't go to a desegregated restaurant and buy a hamburger? That shows partly the influence of Byard Rustin and his fierce embrace of democratic socialism. Byard Rustin was a proud democratic socialist, always tied issues of race and class together. He saw them as inseparable.
Well, Michael Long, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
What a pleasure, Ian. Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Long, who's a professor in religious studies and peace and conflict studies at Elizabethtown College and the author and editor of several books on civil rights, religion, and politics in mid-century America, including Marshalling Justice, The Early Civil Rights Letters of Thurgood Marshall, First Class Citizenship, The Civil Rights Letters of Jackie Robinson, and his latest book, I Must Resist, Byard Rustin's Life in Letters. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the Syrian Electronic Army's cyber attack on the New York Times and Twitter.
But they pinch themselves and squeal, and they'll know that it's for real the hour that the ship comes in. And they'll raise their hands, said, we'll meet all your demands, but we'll shout from the bow, your days are numbered. And like Pharaoh's tribe, they'll be drowned in the tide, and like Goliath, they'll be conquered.
What you wanna do? Wanna be hackers, code crackers, slackers, wasting time with all the chat room yackers, 9 to 5 chilling at Hewlett Packard, working at a desk with a dumb little placard. Yeah, paying the bills with my mad programming skills, defragging my hard drive for thrills. I got me 100 gigabytes of RAM. I never feed trolls and I don't read spam. Install the 2-1 line in my house. Always at my PC, double clicking on my Ms. House.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Alan Paller, who's Director of Research at the SANS Institute, a graduate degree-granting institution, and the Principal Cybersecurity Training School. Alan directs SANS research programs, including the widely used Internet Storm Center, the Early Warning System for the Internet, and the annual Greatest Risks in Cybersecurity study. Alan has testified several times before both the House and the Senate, and eWeek and Baseline magazines have selected Alan as one of the 100 most important people in the information technology industry. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alan Paller.
I'm happy to be here again.
And we always talk whenever there's a cyber attack. It's usually attributed to China, but this one is undoubtedly can be attributed to Syria because the Syrian Electronic Army, by denying service, put up their logo instead of the New York Times, which they've attacked their website and Twitter. So this is, at least they're not trying to hide their signature and who they are.
They are not trying to hide. Sometimes other people will put up a third-party signature to try to put the blame on them, but this one doesn't look like that.
And this is one of this New York Times and Twitter attack that's just taken place. It was preceded earlier by attacks on Britain's Guardian newspaper, the Associated Press, the Washington Post, and the Financial Times. And in fact, the attack on the Associated Press planted a false story that the White House had been bombed and that caused the stock exchange to plunge. So there's been quite a consistent amount of mischief coming from the Syrian Electronic Army.
There has been, and what they've discovered is they want press, and looks like the easiest way to get press is to attack the press, because all of you write about the other guy's problems.
Well, so the Syrian dictator, Assad, they're denying that they're connected to the government, that this is just a spontaneous group of people supporting the Assad regime. But Assad himself has referred to the Syrian Electronic Army as a real army in a virtual reality. So how would you see this, Alan Paller, in terms of cyber warfare? Is this, you know, the beginning of what we can expect? You know, since the Cold War, we've had what loosely referred to as a lot of low-intensity warfare. So are we to expect a lot of low-intensity electronic warfare like this?
This is not what I would call electronic warfare. What I would call this is graffiti. But it's the anger. It happened every time the Israelis and the Palestinians heated up, every time the Chinese and the people in Taiwan, the arguments heated up. There were massive attacks just like these that defaced websites or put websites out of business. And it was a way for the public to say, we're with our government and we're against the other guy's government. So this is not the kind of thing that can cause a lot of damage. The damage in warfare comes when electricity is turned off or power is or telecommunications are turned off or that you destroy the country's ability to act. But this is one that's where people are just screaming loudly and they're looking for press coverage to try to help them make their screams even louder.
But the New York Times, the person at the New York Times who is trying to deal with this, the chief information officer, Mark Franz, has said that this is a very sophisticated attack. This is a big deal.
Well, there are two different things, Ian. It is a big deal, for sure. And it's a big deal because it can take away the trust that the New York Times has built up in the public. If you don't know when you go to the New York Times website, whether you're actually going to the New York Times website, or you might be going to a site where somebody is putting up things that are pretending to be the New York Times stories, that can destroy the reputation of the publication. So it's a big deal for the publication, and it can destroy trust. In fact, when I did a survey of government officials about what they worried most about in cyber attacks, it was that their site would be changed so that no one could trust what they saw there. So it is a big deal. I'm just saying it's not the kind of thing that's disabling to a nation.
So the fact that the Syrian Electronic Army put up their logo and redirect people going to the New York Times expecting to see their front page, in fact, end up looking at the logo for the Syrian Electronic Army, they're in fact doing a favor. It's when they did what they did before with the Associated Press, plant a story that the White House had been bombed. That's when it gets serious. That's the distinction, right?
I think it gets serious both times because although they did change the story last time, this time they changed people's views of what happens when they type nytimes.com into their web browser. And that can last even longer than a single story. So I think both of those were really high intensity attacks for the organization because it can go against their most valuable asset, which is their reputation.
And again, I'm speaking with Alan Paller, who directs research at the SANS Institute, a graduate degree granting institution, and the Principal Cybersecurity Training School. Alan directs SANS research programs, including the widely used Internet Storm Center, the Early Warning System for the Internet, and the annual Greatest Risks in Cybersecurity Study. Alan has testified several times before both the House and the Senate, and eWeek and Baseline magazines selected Alan as one of the 100 most important people in the information technology industry. So, Alan, explain to us how they do these attacks. This Syrian Electronic Army, that's supposedly a freelance group of hackers that just happened to support Syria's dictator Assad. I mean, if you believe that, I got a bridge to sell you, you know.
All right. There are two ways to do a denial of service attack. The way they did it was with what's called DNS hijacking. When you try to type the address of a website, you actually don't type its numerical address, those three digits with a period and another three digits with a period and another three digits. You don't type that. You type its name. So somebody has to translate those names into the actual address. The New York Times address didn't change at all, but the table that said nytimes.com goes to that address was changed, and it was changed officially by the company, it turns out to be in Australia, that registers the domain for the New York Times. So it was an official change. And what they had done is they broke into one of the resellers for that official domain registrar in Australia and just changed the file so that everybody who thought they were going to the New York Times went somewhere else. That's one way to do a denial of service. The other one is to take over 100,000 machines and zombies and have them send traffic to a site. And that's really debilitating because then the site can't do anything. So those are the two ways it happens. In this case, it was DNS hijacking.
So in the latter case, by using zombie machines, how is that done? Where would you find 100,000 different entry points to the Internet? Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, it's actually 100,000 computers. So it's your home computer and everyone else's home computer that may have gone to a website where it got hacked, or they may have opened an email with a malicious attachment, and it has a little program on it that wasn't doing anything. And then the people who did that actually rent out the zombies. You can rent them different prices, but it's not very expensive. So you can rent out 100,000 zombies and use them to send a denial of service attack, or use them to sell Viagra, or use them to do anything that's illegal, but you don't want to get caught. So you cause all those innocent people who got hacked to do your dirty work for you.
Well, my own website, ianmasters.com, has been under attack for several months, and we keep having to work on stopping it. It's a bit like, you know, the myth of Sisyphus. You know, you roll this rock up the hill and it rolls back down on you. So is that what you're talking about? Is this being, they're just continually looking for a way to break in and put Viagra ads and stuff like that? Is that?
Yeah,
what
they're doing to your website, because you're so trusted, is that they're trying to break into yours and make it a site that infects all the visitors, so that they can collect hundreds or thousands of zombies by the people who come visit a site that has been infected. Like American Enterprise Institute was infected, and all the people in the White House, and this was years ago, but people in the White House and others who visited the American Enterprise Institute site got infected. And one of the Department of Homeland Security sites was infecting people, and one of the United Nations sites was infecting people. The way they did that was by breaking into the site, putting a little program in that infects people who come and visit it. And they do that so they can get those zombies, so they can rent them out to do denial of service attacks or email campaigns.
So, Alan Paller, who's doing this? Who are we talking about here?
Three people. One is organized crime groups who have figured out that this is more profitable than drugs and it's less likely to get you killed. So sometime in the last 24 months, the amount of money being made by organized crime groups appears to have passed the drug trade, but there's no census, so that's an estimate by law enforcement people. But anyway, they're the same order of magnitude. So that's one group. The second group is military people. In general, they're doing espionage, and they're doing espionage to pick up military secrets early. So they're attacking government contractors, for example, to try to get the early data about new radars or other new systems before they're even built, so that they can learn how to defend them. And then the third is, there's also a terrorist group that is doing a lot of this, but they're very much like the organized crime group. So the third is these general people who are just angry at the world, and they aren't doing it for money, and they aren't doing it for military reasons. But you remember Anonymous?
Mm-hmm.
These people in Syria are angry at somebody, and they want to lash out. So they're using cyber attacks to do that. But those are the three groups that are doing it.
So Alan Peller, again, director of research at the SANS Institute. The first group, organized crime, you say that they're making more money off the internet than they do from drug trafficking and other criminal activities that might get them killed. Well, how do they make the money? I mean, is this through conning little old ladies out of their savings? What do they do?
I'll give you the most direct way they make money. This is an attack that's hit lots of churches, lots of small businesses, lots of nonprofits. They send out a phishing email. That's an email that looks like it's something you should open, but you shouldn't. So it looks like it might be from another church, and it has something important. It says something important. You're not very careful. So you open the attachment, and that infects your machine. Then they sit on your machine until you use that machine in the office to go check up on your bank account, or to check your deposits from the collections that you did on Sunday, and then they move all of the money out of your account into their own accounts. And this is it's a very big crime. The FBI reported about $400 million 2 years ago. I haven't heard a new number, but that's the most direct way. Another really direct way is they buy Google ads for IRS automated entry of tax returns. So you want to do your tax return online, they'll buy Google ads. You fill out your form. You go to their site. Looks legal. Google sold the ad. You fill out your form. As soon as you fill it out, it goes to the IRS. But just before it goes to the IRS, they change the bank address for where the refund should go to a bank in a country that doesn't have any extradition treaties. So it steals your refund checks. That's the most automated attack we know. That one's a completely automated attack. But most of the money is made on those Viagra ads and the spear phishing. So most of it's made by taking over websites, using the website to infect a lot of personal computers, using the personal computers to send out Viagra ads or ads for other things people don't want, or denial of service attacks. And then the denial of service attacks are used for extortion, so that, for example, all the online gambling sites were paying, almost all of them were paying extortion a few years ago, because the bad guys would use lots of zombies to send huge amounts of traffic on a Saturday afternoon when the bettors were trying to get in, and the gambling sites were told if you don't pay, those are up to $1 million of extortion. If you don't pay $1 million, we will keep this up, and you'll never make another dollar. So extortion is a good way to do it. Taking money that's already flowing is a good way to do it. Making zombies and selling them to people who want to use them for sending trash email or denial of service is a good way to do it. But it's a lot of money.
So then, presumably, the group that you mentioned that sell Viagra ads, Viagra must pay them, right?
These are fake Viagra.
Oh, I see.
This is fake stuff. It's people trying to sell things that don't exist.
Oh, I see. So it has nothing to do with...
See a lot of the Viagra ads.
I see. So this is not...
They're the same people who will send out, after a hurricane, they'll send out millions of emails saying, please give money to the Red Cross. Just send your money here. It'll have nothing to do with the Red Cross.
So how many people work for these people? I mean, what would one of these kind of boiler room internet operations look like?
There isn't an operation. It's a whole supply chain where one group makes the fake ATM cards. For there's another attack where you take over banks and you make fake ATM cards and you take money out of the ATM machine. So one guy will take over the bank. One guy will make the cards. One guy will find ways of doing the money, and each of them uses the other ones as part of their supply chain. And in these attacks, one will be trying to break into your site to take over your server. And then once he does that, he'll capture a lot of zombies. Then he'll rent the zombies. He'll actually give the zombies to an aggregator who will sell them, and he'll take, and the first guy will take some money off it, and the aggregator will take some money off it, and then the person who wants to send out the bad emails will be a third person. So it's not really one organization, usually.
So given that everything has a fingerprint, it seems, in the electronic ether, how's law enforcement doing then? I mean, it's not as if at the end of the day you can't track these people down, but is there, what, insufficient resources, or are they just cleverer? What's the explanation?
Law enforcement is doing a really good job. The numbers are just breathtaking. So I did a survey in Melbourne in Australia of all the 12th and 13th graders and said, how many of you have broken into a computer that doesn't belong to you? And this was 6 years ago, and 3% of the boys said they had. And I was doing a class at a high school, of super smart kids high school in outside of D.C. in Maryland, and I said, how many of you have a computer at home? And everyone stood up. I said, stay standing if you've used that computer to break into a computer that doesn't belong to you. And 30% of those kids stayed standing. And I remember the teacher standing next to me said, not you too, Jenny. it's too easy. So the answer to your question is law enforcement is doing great, but it's being overwhelmed by the numbers.
But you're not suggesting these school kids end up working for organized crime, are you?
It's interesting. I don't have data in the United States, but in Russia, a lot of the most prolific attackers were bright kids who were out on the internet doing things they shouldn't have been doing and bragged. And they got picked up by these organized crime groups. And then when the kids didn't want to break the law, their families were threatened. One of them was actually sent to Africa and had to work from Africa because he didn't have any families. And they said, if you want to eat, you hack. And some of them have been caught. That's why we know these stories. But the organized crime groups, especially in Russia, don't take prisoners. I mean, they're vicious. So these kids can get hooked into it, not because they planned to go to become criminals. They just were exploring when they were doing their work, but they got good at it, and they got to be bragging about what they could do, and so they got picked up.
Well, Alan Paller, it's been an interesting conversation, and I really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Alan Paller, who is the Director of Research at the SANS Institute, a graduate degree granting institution, and the principal cybersecurity training school. Alan directs SANS research programs, including the widely used Internet Storm Center, the early warning system for the Internet, and the annual Greatest Risks in Cybersecurity study. Alan has testified several times before both the House and the Senate, and eWeek and Baseline magazines selected Alan as one of the 100 most important people in the information technology industry. This is Beam Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline.